everyone. Let's start. Welcome to the Freud Museum and this evening's talk. Those who don't know me, I'm Carol Siegel. I'm director of the Freud Museum. And it's a real pleasure this evening to introduce Professor Welter. Unlike many of the speakers who come, Professor Welter really has a kind of long and happy relationship with the Freud Museum. He's conducted a great deal of his research.
Trying not to spoil that.
A great deal of his research here, and I think a lot of material is actually in tonight's talk and in the book. So we're really thrilled that he has been able to come and talk. Particularly, as you see, comes quite a distance, now based at Santa Barbara, the University of California. So, you know, it's great that he's been able to make time in his travel schedule and actually come to the Freud Museum and give this talk about Ernst Freud. And, of course, Ernst Freud is somebody who, again, is very important in the history of this house. It was Ernst Freud who found it for his parents in 1938, arranged for it to be purchased, and who then converted it for his parents to use. So there is a particular kind of resonance to the story of Ernst Freud that we're going to hear tonight. And if you haven't been to the house before, you know, I hope that you'll come back and look in more detail, but you might be interested to know particularly that we've just refurbished the Anna Freud room. And in fact, one of the items that's on display, newly on display, is actually a letter from Anna to her brother Ernst that she wrote in 1919. So you might have a chance just to look at that as well at the end of tonight's talk. Also just to say that Professor Welter's book, which some of you I know have already seen and bought in the shop, but there'll be another chance, the shop will still be open at the end of tonight's talk, and there'll be a chance to go down and buy it if you haven't, and I think you're going to be happy, aren't you, to sign if need be.
Yes.
And also at the end of the talk to answer any questions. So thank you very much for coming to talk, and really look forward to hearing what you're going to be saying.
Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks for the very, very nice introduction, and I'm very, very happy to be here to give a talk on Freud. I was here quite often throughout those many years I actually pursued Freud, and so it's a very nice sort of happy conclusion that the book is finally out, the papers have been all deposited in an archive, there's nothing Freudian in my house left in California, and I don't think there shall be a new collection of Freudiana. And so I think this is sort of the final point then for me to give this talk at the Freud Museum about this very gentleman, Ernst Freud, how he's standing there. So what I'm going to do tonight, I was sort of thinking, well, I want to talk about 50 minutes, maybe I can just about do 60 minutes, and then how do you cut this down? And I decided I want to look at two points. First is work in London. So I selected various buildings in London and a few around London. But what I want to do with those buildings is not simply presenting them, but I want to look how Freud actually translates certain ideas about German modern architecture into the British or English context. Because I think exile, if you get pushed or if you go into exile, sort of is in a certain way a process of translation. You have to adjust to a new environment, you have to come to terms with that your old home country, and Freud, even though he was born in Vienna, did live in Berlin for many years, and we'll talk about this a little later. So he kind of takes something with him into this new environment, and I think one can trace this very nicely in his architecture. And then I have a second part, which I was very much thinking, shall I do this? And then I thought, okay, in the end, I'm going to do it because I know many of you want to see the psychoanalytical consulting rooms. So I put everything together on these consulting rooms. And just in case you wonder about the couches, we will talk about this. And I know, or I assume, that there are psychoanalysts, therapists in the audience. So just to put this right away, I stubbornly refuse to ever put myself on a couch. I just studied them, I looked at them, and once again, I have no intention to undergo this therapeutic process myself. However, what I really like about this particular photograph is, this, I think, really sums up Ernst Freud. And it's a little bit annoying. I never saw this photograph when I researched this. And then afterwards, it was used to illustrate an article I wrote for an online magazine, and I really liked this photograph. This is Freud in his house in St. John's Wood, in his English or in his London home. And I love how he sort of stands at his desk, telephone, and you can see the paraphernalia on the desk, sort of the phone, the notebook, the pen. And this is Freud doing his work as an architect, but I think it also shows sort of the aspiration Freud had for himself as an architect. He was a really good Bürger, as we say in the German language, a bourgeois. A good middle-class, well-educated young man, or here obviously already an older man, who sort of catered as an architect for his particular social class. So he designed houses, homes, for doctors, medical doctors, analysts, for therapists, for lawyers, lots of doctors who just had a doctor title without us knowing really in what kind of discipline they had their doctor title. And so I think this image sums up very nicely where he sees himself as an architect. And here we have a slightly different view of the same sort of living room. So here the windows are closed and you can fold them all away so that you can open up this entire, the door, and then you can open up the window so you have a nice indoor-outdoor relationship. But there is something else going on in this photograph, and that is that this image persistently cites Berlin. There is so much Berlin in this photograph. And that, I think, is the other side of Freud. This is his London home. We know that Freud, in 1933, made a deliberate decision very early on in 33. Berlin is no longer our home. We can no longer live in Berlin. And so he was one of those Jewish citizens, or in his case obviously had an Austrian passport, Austrian-Hungarian passport, one of very early on who realized things are going to be not good for our people or for us, so we have to get out of it. That meant that Freud could take many, many things with him from Berlin into exile, and those are the things which we can see here in this image. You think this is just a modern environment, but I just identified a few of these things. This is Freud's study in Berlin. The second Berlin home, he had three homes in Berlin, only from the second home, where he lived from roughly 24 to 32, is photographically documented. In 32, he moves with his family into his third Berlin home, where they only lived till sometime in late 1933. But what we can see here, to start, for example, with the fireplace, there is a nice sort of iron grill in front of the fireplace. It is exactly the same he has in his house in St. John's Wood. Look at these beautiful chairs he designed for himself. They look very beautiful. I'm not quite sure how comfortable they were, but then if you're 6'5", maybe most chairs aren't really that comfortable. So they're very cubic, and these ones here have armrests. This chair here is from the same series, although it doesn't have the armrests, so there he had several of those. And then, very, very nice, here we have a bust of his wife, Lucy Freud. This was a portrait bust which was produced by a Berlin-based sculptor, Joachim Karsch. It was a bronze bust which was done around October 1929. I don't know where this bust is today, but Lucy is obviously keeping an eye on what her husband is doing on the desk. And if we look at his office in Berlin, where this was his Berlin desk, the desk apparently did not make its way into exile to Berlin, but the desk was standing somewhere here. So in his Berlin office, he was facing his bookshelves, whereas in the London office, much smaller, he had the books behind it, but he also placed a little bust up here. I have this photograph enlarged and enlarged and enlarged, but I have not been able to identify what this particular sculpture is. But I think it's quite interesting that he has to place some sort of bust, some figure of a person in sort of almost similar spatial relationship to his desk as he does in his London apartment. And so we could go on with a number of things. One item has changed. These bookshelves were not Freud's bookshelves in Berlin. These are from his friend Koyanka. For some reason, Freud couldn't remove his own bookshelves. They were apparently so well fixed to the walls that he made a swap and he took a different client's bookshelves with him to London. But that's just a small detail. So I think this is a very nice example that this process of making home for himself and for his family, obviously in London, from an architectural historical point of view or from a point of view about domesticity, how do we make home, is in the case of Freud a process of translation, of transferal of certain objects and the memories, obviously, which are attached with them. It is obviously also a financial decision, because these furnitures, they were all made to measure in Berlin, and so this is a financial investment, which at least in the case of Ernst and Lucy Freud, they could carry this over into their new home in London. So let's step back a little bit, and I cut really short the biographical information, but a few things I think are very important for us to know. So he was born in 1892, passed away in 1970. He was a school friend with Richard Neutra, the most famous Austrian-Hungarian architect when Austria-Hungary still existed, who became really famous in California after the First World War. Richard Neutra eventually made its way from Berlin into California, into the United States, and then in California, where he has become the most famous, besides Rudolf Schindler, his Austrian colleague, the most famous mid-20th century modern architect. So Freud and Neutra, they were school friends, childhood friends from their teens, early teens on in Vienna. Freud studies architecture at the TH Vienna, the Technische Hochschule. He is there from winter 1911 to summer term 1913. Continental European universities mostly have semester system, and we have one, the winter semester, which starts sort of around October, comes to an end around March, and then around February, and then in March till somewhere in early summer, there is the summer semester or summer term. And Freud attends the Bauschule, which was a private architecture school of maybe the most radical Viennese architect, Adolf Loos, and he's famous for the Loos House in the center of Vienna, right across the Imperial Hofburg, one of the earliest houses which has no historical ornament, a big scandal around this house in the design. So Freud attaches himself with this very radical Viennese architect. Adolf Loos was one of the earliest modernists in Vienna. Loos sets up a private architecture school in autumn 1912, and Freud attends the first year. So goes the story. The only evidence we actually have, other than looking at his architecture, and I'll show you some similarities a little later, the only evidence we have that he actually was at this school is by another friend who also attended the school. Now, this friend, he wrote his kind of a brief memoir at some point in the early 1980s, and he describes Freud as being the most unreliable student we can imagine. He comes and goes at his own will. So Freud obviously sometimes attended the lecture, sometimes showed up to class, and more often obviously didn't show up to class. He seems to have shown up especially to those classes which Adolf Loos conducted in a pub. He liked to meet his students in a pub, so that's when Freud was there. Sometimes he went on tours through various houses he designed. And Adolf Loos is very important for sort of domestic architecture. This is one of his interiors. So Freud attended the first year of this very famous private architecture school. And then he does what most continental European student does. You do the first 2 years at one university, you get an intermediate diploma, the so-called Vordiplom, and then you go to a different university. That is the tradition in the continental system, so that you broaden your horizon by attending different universities. Freud then moves to Munich in Bavaria. Now, I am a Berliner, so Bavaria is a word on its own. As the Bavarians think, the Berliners are a bit weird. However, so I talk a little bit about Munich, and then I move to Berlin. And then we get to the really interesting stuff. Munich, however, before the First World War, Munich was the center of modern art in Germany, in the German-speaking countries. That's where Jugendstil, the German version of Art Nouveau, was kind of invented and conceived. So Munich, for a young architect, was the place to be before the First World War. It changed immediately after the First World War, then Berlin became the place to be. So he goes to the Technische Hochschule in Munich. He starts in the winter 1913, summer 1914, and then, of course, the First World War breaks out, or begins. So Freud is immediately drafted into... he volunteers for the Austro-Hungarian army. This photograph was very easy to find. I asked the university in Munich, do you have Freud's application? And they said, yes, we have Freud's application, so they send it to me. And that's how we have an additional photograph of Ernst Freud with his own signature. That's the photograph he used when he re-registered at some point while being a soldier with the university in Munich. So his studies in Munich, they are kind of... patchwork. He starts, then the war interrupts, he re-enrolls. Eventually, however, he does graduate in April 1919, so after the war has come to an end in November 1918, he actually graduates in Munich, and there is a wonderful description by Lou Andre Salome, where she says sort of Freud was there and he just graduated and we had kind of drinks, and this was also the time when in Munich there was a socialist revolution going on there, and Freud sort of is a little bit aloof to all this. So this is his kind of bourgeois personality, so that he celebrates his graduation while outside, sort of on the streets of Munich, a serious attempt is obviously undergoing to set up a socialist republic, which worked for a few months, and then of course sort of the right-wing forces crushed this attempt to build up a different notion of how you can have a democratic Germany. However, far more important for Freud is he meets this wonderful young woman, Lucy Brasch. He meets her, he falls in love, and they marry, and that's the reason why he moved to Berlin. Very straightforward. It was a love story. Lucy Brasch was a student in Munich. She studied, I think, German languages, philology, and she studied some art history in Munich. She never finished her degree. Very typical at that time also for young women to start studying at the university and as soon as you sort of meet the man you want to share your life with, they often never finished their studies. But she is for a while in Munich. They actually lived a few houses apart, sort of in two streets within the student quarters. Lucy Brasch comes from a Berlin family, very wealthy family of grain merchants in Berlin. So they had big land holdings east of Berlin, sort of direction Leipzig, Dresden, in that area. They had big land holdings. They had country house, the manor house there. And they were trading in grain, obviously lots of the grain which came from former German areas, East Prussia, that was where the German Empire or the German nation grew its foodstuff. So very, very wealthy family, very sort of well settled in a social network in Berlin. And so Freud marries her and he marries into this family. It's not quite that easy because Freud at that time also was ill. He had some lung ailments. I could never quite figure out if he really had TB or if it was an early version of TB, but he marries her, then he has to go into a sanatorium, and then Sigmund Freud is terribly embarrassed, sort of thinks, what are the parents of Brasch is thinking? I'm marrying my son with their daughter, and then we have to come up with all this money for the sanatorium. So there's lots of kind of heartbreak and worries about sort of can they kind of maintain this very delicate relationship, but it didn't cause any lasting harm that the Brashes apparently helped the Freuds to pay for this prolonged medical treatment, so that Ernst eventually comes out of the sanatorium something like 20 kilograms more heavy, and sort of everybody seems to be happy that he overcame this particular medical problem. So they marry in May 1920, and Freud immediately starts building and designing houses. That is actually rather unusual, because May 1920, the German economy was in sort of in the doldrums, to put it politely. Obviously, the whole social structure of Germany had collapsed in with the collapse of the monarchy. There were sort of the early beginnings of the left-wing forces, the right-wing forces, and Freud moves to Berlin, basically only knows his wife and his wife's family, and starts building houses. So he really has sort of a career start, very, very unusual for many young architects, especially those who came back from being soldiers, if they survived being soldiers, and then for many of them this was a really hard period. Neutra is an example for exactly the other sort of experience. Neutra makes his way from the Balkan to Switzerland, eventually comes to Berlin, lives in absolutely horrendous circumstances in some rented room, has nothing to eat, has no job, so Freud offers Neutra that he can design the gardens for the houses he is building, so they're collaborating on this, and then Neutra eventually hits sort of the jackpot, as we would say in America, when he starts working with Eric Mendelssohn, and this is the connection then to move to the United States. So lots of marriage going on. Here is an image of Neutra and his wife, sort of they marry in Germany but in a different city. And then Freud is quite successful in Berlin. And why am I calling this successful? The number of clients, the names of clients, those of you who are familiar with German history, if you look through the list of works at the end of the book, sort of you have a who is who of the liberal German Jewish bourgeoisie in Berlin, the Mosse publishing house, the Fischer publishing house, big banking names, those are the clients for Freud. How did he get his clients? Very, very difficult to figure out. There will be lots of family connections through the Brasches, which as an established Berlin family were married in various other German Jewish families. Freud also designs a lot for non-Jewish bourgeois clients, so it is not entirely correct, or one cannot entirely say that he only designs for Jewish German citizens. He also works for other ones. It was very, very difficult to really establish which clients sort of has what kind of background. 1933, what we know, the Germans voted Adolf Hitler into power, and then it took a few more months for Hitler to really sort of grab this political system to sort of really begin to sort of solidify his political power in Germany. And then Freud does something really interesting. June to August, he on his own goes to London. And it's an exploratory trip how to set up exile in London. So he comes here to London, he rents a room, he meets some member of the Melanie Klein family, and he enrolls with their English teacher, so he starts learning English right away. He's very strategic about this. He meets sort of important British architects. He talks to them, when can I do work, how can we set up these sort of what work possibilities are there for me. He actually goes to London with a portfolio of photographs of his work in Berlin. He shows it around. He arranges that his work gets published in British architectural magazines. So he's extremely, am I allowed to say, very Germanic. He's very organized in setting things up so that hopefully nothing goes wrong. He sorts out the schooling for the children. He figures out financially that if the children go to boarding school, then he and Lucy can live in an apartment where they can also have the office. That saves him so many pounds per week. So he sort of lays it all out. And once he is happy with the preparations, which of course are not that easy and not that smoothly going, he needs to work with a British architect, an English architect, so that he can actually build. So somebody must have signed his early plans. I have never been able to find out who he actually collaborated with. But he goes back in September, in August to Berlin, and then Lucy and Ernst packing up their entire apartment. They're dismantling the furniture and they're shipping everything from Berlin to London. Lucy and the kids, the three boys, they are put on the train and they travel to London in September, and then begins a very intense period with Ernst and Lucy writing letters to each other every single day. Freud sometimes writes for 2 days, twice a day, a letter, and he is waiting for the German Inland Revenue Services, the tax office, to kind of give the official stamp that he can really export all these possessions, not necessarily monetary possessions, but the object. That was possible because it took for the National Socialists some time to put their dictatorship into sort of full power because they did these things strictly according to the law. It sounds really bizarre, but if you look at the way sort of they're tightening gradually all these different regulations which no longer allow you to take things out of Germany where you have to pay a special tax if you want to remove your furnitures, most of them were not yet in place when the Freuds were leaving. So they were kind of lucky, if one can use this word in the context of being kicked out into exile, they were kind of lucky that they decided to leave really early, but there are some very nerve-wracking letters where he says it can only be another day until I have this final signature. So he sort of supervises the final dismantling, and then at some point he suddenly says, this is the last letter I write from Berlin, I'm on the train tomorrow, and then he arrives in November in London. So that's sort of briefly, and then his career in London. I will talk a little bit about this in the remainder of my talk. So that is in a nutshell, sort of the major stages in his biography. Once he is in London, and here we have a photograph of the couple. This is 1 year before Ernst then passes away, and I was, this is an error in my book. I identified this building in the background as their house in St. John's Wood, and the longer I look at this photograph, I think this is wrong. This must be the cottage in Warberswick. So you may want to correct the caption in the book. I'm not sure what page number it's on, but there is one other error which I also put in my talk because I thought this is a good opportunity to set the record straight where I got things wrong. Briefly, a little more biography. So here we have the couple in the 1920s. Apparently, there is some very cryptic German inscription on the reverse of this photograph where whoever wrote this inscription hints in a very metaphorical manner that apparently Lucy is pregnant. So probably with Stephen Gabriel, the first son, who we have down here, and then obviously Ernst Freud, and then these giants in the generation before and in the generation of his own children, and then I don't think I have to introduce in London Sir Clement Freud, although somebody could probably tell me what on earth he was doing there with the dog and the canned food, and then a photograph of Stephen Freud, who still is with us, but who is unfortunately too frail to be with us tonight. So he has those three sons, and they obviously, and then the children of the sons, they sort of begin this process of integrating themselves into the society of their new home country probably for Lucy and Ernst, whereas for the boys one wonders if it is really new in that sense. Very beautiful, there are these few letters downstairs in one of the rooms, letters which Lucien writes really early on, and if you know German language, there's one letter in particular where you can really see how he loses his ability to write German, and he begins sort of to introducing orthographical mistakes, which become quite understandable if you know what English word he is obviously thinking about. So he begins confusing K's and C's. And it's very nice to see that letter because it's really sort of this line where his language begins to shift. Okay, let's move briefly back to Berlin, and I took here a modern map of Berlin to sort of give you some idea where they actually lived. So this here is Potsdamer Platz. So those of you who are familiar with the topography of Berlin, Potsdamer Platz traditionally the center of modern Berlin, and nowadays they try again to reinstitute this as a center. That's a different story. And this is where the Freuds lived. In this street and in this street were their three Berlin apartments. So they really lived right in the center of Berlin, but very interesting, they lived on the western side. So over here is East Berlin, over here is West Berlin, somewhere over here starts Kurfürstendamm. So they lived in the western part of Berlin, where here the big central park begins, the Tiergarten in Berlin, very, very posh area. You had money if you lived there. You had money when you lived there, and you had aspirations to be seen as living in an area where people with money lived. The first house, the first apartment was the Gentenstrasse, number 11. That street still exists. It's today called Hitzigallee. So that's that particular street here. There are barely any private apartment buildings left on that street. For architecture enthusiasts, right here on the corner, we have the famous Shell House, a very sort of iconic modernist building in Berlin. 1924, they move in the same street to number 23, so they're still on this street, and then 1931, 32, 233, they move into Matthäikirchstraße, and that street doesn't exist anymore. So it was with all the changes after the Second World War and the division of Berlin. This is the Berlin Philharmonic Concert Hall. This is the famous New National Gallery by Mies van der Rohe, the art museum. So the gallery sort of occupies part of where the street used to be. But this was an even more respectable address than Regentenstrasse. So it was really a move upwards in the social stratum in Berlin. By the way, another hint for architecture enthusiasts, down here was Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's office on Karlsbad. So that was the center of Berlin. And then in Potsdamer Straße, somewhere around here, we also had the first clinic, the polyclinic of psychoanalytic treatment. So that was the area where Freud's were living in Berlin. This is one of the first houses he designs in Berlin. And this is always sort of where then the tension takes downward move, because this is not exciting. It's just a nice, ordinary house in Berlin. It's a two-family house, which a gentleman built for his two daughters in order to entice them to marry. So he kind of threw in this entire house. This was a family which made its money with producing cardboard for boxes and things. The family lives today in New York. It's a nice house, but it is also a little boring, sort of architecturally speaking. Neutra was extremely jealous that Freud built this house. Neutra, of course, was in Berlin, had no work to do, was kind of feeling really the pressure, and so he writes in one of his diaries, which are preserved at the University of California in Los Angeles, that Freud and his wife are full of happy expectations. So there's obviously a little baby on its way. Earned in a wealthy household, he has two houses for three families under construction and is doing things cleverly. So one house was this double house where two families lived in one house, and then there was another building under construction in Berlin, which rather interestingly today is the Iranian embassy. So for inexplicable reasons, I always failed to get access to that building. I tried several times, but there was no response to my letter. So we shall see. So at some point, maybe I will succeed. This building was 1922. It's demolished since 1973. It doesn't exist anymore. 1925. This is the first modern building of Freud. So completely different architectural language. The house now has flat roofs, it's cubic, it's a box, very, very beautiful brick. It's a dark aubergine-colored brick, which was burnt at a really high temperature, so the surface really glazes off the brick. Very, very beautiful material, very typical for Berlin in the 1920s to use that particular brick. There's this little bit of sort of abstract geometric ornamentation where we have here these projecting layers of the brick, and the house evokes some ideas of Lossian houses in Vienna, but it is only modern on the outside. On the inside, very traditional floor plan. So here we have the lower floor of the house with the living room, a small workspace. This is the main entrance into her house, and then here is the kind of foyer space, and then you go through a door into the actual sort of staircase upstairs, and then kitchen and dining area, and then the private bedrooms, they are all on the upper level, and then there was a kind of terrace here on the house where it is only where it's missing the so the third floor is only a half floor. Very interesting. The clients were Lampe, They were, he came from Vienna. They were both, she was of a Dutch background. They were both in the psychoanalytical or psychotherapeutical movement. Sort of they practiced in Berlin in some of these psychoanalytic clinics. And they had their own clinic. This also is the first house where Freud includes a psychoanalytical consulting room, which is hidden because here it says ARB, which is an abbreviation for work. That's the office space. But we know that was where they treated private clients. So when you entered the house, there was a small sort of area here where you can put your coat down, a small bathroom. This is the actual waiting room. So a patient was led into the waiting room, and then whoever was in the treatment room then was led out the same way, and then the other person was led in so that they kind of don't meet each other. Where was the couch in this room? We don't know. We have a few, we have some interior images, but they don't really show us where the couch was. But I think there's almost only one space for the couch, and it's probably somewhere in this corner. Assuming that you will not put the couch underneath a window, in terms of avoiding draft and so on in a very cold Berlin winter. But we don't know. The only photographs we have is then of the actual living room. These are two bookshelves, and here was a private desk. That has been photographed, but the actual consulting room has not been photographed. And the family, they are today, or for many decades again, they live in Holland. They have lots of photographs, but they also could not contribute any photograph of the consulting room. But it is a modern house. It fits right into modern architecture in the mid-1920s in Berlin. And then in the late 1920s, the largest house Freud will ever build in his entire career. This is a big country house on the outskirts of Berlin. This is the Schwielersee, so the house looks over this, over the lake into the flat sort of landscape around Berlin. The largest house Freud ever built. He designed the entire building, the entire interior sort of decoration. And this is also the house where I, for the first time, encountered the name Freud. When I was still working as an architect in the restoration of listed buildings, after the wall came down, the office I was employed got a commission. This is a photograph I took in 1991 of this building, and you can see it's dilapidated condition. We got the initial commission to start restoring or beginning the preparation of the restoration of the building. This is how the building appears today. There lives a gentleman there from Leipzig who somehow through purchased this ground, and he has restored this building in a really lovely way. The family, the clients, the Franks, they I actually met again in Santa Barbara, where they managed to flee Germany only in 1938, very, very late. They kind of just about got out, and through south of France, they eventually ended up in America. And they have a son in Santa Barbara who's my age, who is an architect, who built one house precisely in his entire architectural career, a house for his parents on the coastline in Santa Barbara, which cites this building, and once he finished the house, he changed his profession, he became a psychotherapist. So there seems to be something wrong with being an architect in relation to that. However, that's just the family. And this is the view of the house. This also is sort of the real trophy piece architecture Freud actually designed. Who were the clients? We have here Theodor Frank, or Theodor Frank. He was a manager of Deutsche Bank. So he was one manager of one of the leading banking institutes then, and with some up and down still today. And he was born in the 1870s. He was an elder for Freud, an older client, who decided that Freud designs his house. They had a townhouse in the center of Berlin, and this became their weekend house, which partially a building for representative functions where they had to receive other managers of other banks. So it was not entirely a private home. It was kind of in between. This is the only photograph we have of his wife, Margot Frank. She This was a function in the 1930s, the early 1930s, some celebration of some jubilee or anniversary of somebody in the management of the bank. So these are the big wigs of the Deutsche Bank in the early 1930s. They, as I said, left Berlin only in 1938, so the Deutsche Bank actually kind of shielded them until 1938. They had removed him from his management post, but they kept him on the advisory board. They kept paying his salary until in 1938 the pressure became so strong to not have any Jewish management person or anybody with any Jewish connection in the management, so they let him go. And they fled initially to Belgium, then to the south of France, and then all I could figure out with the grandson of this gentleman that we could work out on which train Margot Frank was in 1942. She was captured by the Gestapo in either in Nizza or in Paris, that's not quite clear, and she was transported to Auschwitz, and so she was murdered in 1942. Theodor Frank survives, and he lives later on in Zurich. He gets his pension rights reinstated. He gets a reconstitution for this building, and then there's another big reconstitution procedure in when East Germany collapses, but he passes away in the early 1950s as one family member described, as a somewhat bitter man, and I think that's probably was a very polite way of putting it. If we look at this building, however, as architectural historian, this building was from 1945 onwards in East Germany. It was not very well known. The East Germans used the building as an orphanage, as they used many of these big country houses as orphanages for orphans whose parents had either died or disappeared during the war. This is the garden facade, and I think it's very interesting, 1928 to 1930, that is the same time when Ludwig Mies van der Rohe builds the famous Tugendhat Villa in Brünn in the Czech Republic, or Eric Mendelssohn builds his own house am Ruppenhorn in Berlin. So these big, big bourgeois houses, they are preferably located high on the ground so that you get a deep view into the surrounding countryside, and I think this house can be put into the same tradition of these very, very famous examples of modernist architecture in the German context. Very briefly, a look at the floor plan. This is the Freudian floor plan. You enter the house here, the reception hall, the dressing room or the Wohnzimmer, the gentleman's office, the smoking room or the library, and then the dining room and the kitchen, and then upstairs there are endless small bedrooms so that you could accommodate a number of guests. But you can also see here, if we look at the Mies van der Rohe floor plan, a really radical floor plan where we have no longer rooms defined traditionally with four walls. So this is an open flowing floor plan where you come down the stair and then it's sort of all open, and then you have this big glass facade which you can lower into the ground. And so the Freudian floor plan looks far more traditional. We have rooms, really defined rooms. So that's where Freud really is the Viennese modernist, who is not so much interested in a radical gesture in his architecture, but more interested in creating a representative sort of context where you can see how guests are circling around when you have, for example, a dinner function for the bank. Eric Mendelssohn's floor plan is somewhat in between. Here is a view of the house from, there is a circular terrace here in the end where you can then look onto the facade of the building. And Mies van der Rohe did something similar with the Tugendhat house, and that was obviously the purpose, that once you have been guided through the house, you end up here, and then you can look back at this jewel piece of architecture which your wealth allowed you to actually put up. So the social function of these houses is very, very important, obviously for this particular social layer of sort of the upper middle classes, and these clients, especially the Tugendhats and the Franks, they were really, really wealthy sort of in their possessions. These are two some interior shots. This is the reception hall. So once you enter the house here, here is the fireplace and the two doors on either side, which we can one door here, the fireplace of Freud, and then these chairs with these floral patterns, very, very Viennese patterns, nice, beautiful linoleum and dark green on the floor. That was sort of the standard material at that time. And then this stair railing here is the one here, so this open staircase place where you can look up into this upper level from where you access the bedrooms. This is Makassar ebony wood. I mean, it's the most exquisite and bronze railings, and then these sandblasted glass, indirect lighting. It was just wealth translated into very beautiful, very tasteful interior decoration. As a comparison, a house by Adolf Loos, the Viennese modernist, from exactly the same period, the Müller House in Prague, where he has this open staircase, so there is some similarity. But what I think one also sees that Loos is the true master, and Freud is at that time still the learning sort of architect. Now, what he would have done after this house, we don't know. He began building a house for another family, the Mosse family, from the publishing family in Berlin, a country house, but he only has a chance to build the Chauffeur garage building, and then the National Socialism takes over, and the project was never completed, never finished, so we have no really opportunity to sort of say, was this the climax of his career, this building, or was that the stepping stone for even better architectural buildings? We don't know, because that part of his career was obviously cut off or cut short, and he then moved to London. However, let's look at some of his London examples. So here again, the Frank Villa in comparison to the townhouses in Frognal Close. And again, this is the scheme which, to me, all I can see in this building is Berlin. It's sort of cries out Berlin, Berlin in every little corner. Very interesting. First, I think the massing of the house, these volumes stacked together, that seems to somehow come back in these semi-detached houses where we have one townhouse here, another one there. So there may be some similarity. But I think the sort of origin of this scheme is an even different one. The original plan was to have six individual houses, two on this side, two at the far, and two on this side. And there was some argument with the town planning and the planning permission, and so those six villas then got merged into three semi-detached houses, two here, two there, two there. Now, we have an extremely famous example in Berlin architectural history. Neutra and Mendelssohn designed the Sommerfeld housing scheme in Zehlendorf in Berlin. And the scheme was to have four houses along the street and then two, six houses in the back. Only those four ever were built. These ones were never built. But I have a strong suspicion, and these six were built, and these four were not built. And here we have an image of these small houses in Berlin. And if you look at this corner here, the way it recedes, the way the roof projects outward, the window, and one sort of has the feeling that Freud, when he designed that from the close scheme, somehow was probably thinking of, or remembering, or maybe citing some sort of vague memories he had from these Berlin houses. So again, we have here on the one hand, they look very, very English in the sort of material, in the steel-framed windows, and then there are these little references where he sort of never seems to quite get away from the modernism of Berlin architecture. The same with another house for a banker, Adolf von Heide Marx. In Neville Drive, they left Berlin already in 1932. They left even before National Socialism became officially established. They were bankers, great art collectors, and they, again, could take everything with them they had in Berlin. So they took their entire art collection with them, and you can see here these paintings of Pechstein and Haeckel. So they were kind of these modern expressionist, impressionists. That was sort of the scene, art scene they were collecting. And this is the house Freud designs for them in London. This is the garden facade of the house with nice brickwork, steel, crittle steel frame windows, and then he puts this hip roof on the house. And then this is the interior. Very interesting. All the furnishings come apparently from the Berlin house. And so Freud sort of puts them against this light wall surface. Very often his walls were covered with some textile fabric. And then he puts these dark furnitures against them so that they really stand out. And I think he does this almost deliberately, sort of to use the furnitures to give these people in exile sort of these resting points. curtains, where you can sort of almost, you know, you look through your living room or something and you see the furnitures and they are well known to you. You have grown up with them, you lived with them in your earlier home, and so he has very often this contrast of dark furnitures against light background, and then obviously the art collection. And then again, if we look at this at architecture, there are two houses in Berlin by a Swiss architect, and again you can see these window divisions, three windows on the upper level, these bank of windows on the lower level, and then in the far distance this sort of terrace, and then here the house for Flechtheim, where we have the same sort of smaller windows, larger banks of windows, and then this terrace with a garden seat at the far end. And that's the other mistake in my book. This is the house for Julius Flechtheim. He was a manager of IG Farben, the big chemical company, which later then acquired fame for sort of being the inventors and distributors of the gas which was used in the gas chambers, and it's not Alfred Flechtheim. This is also very interesting that I made this mistake, because that's what you read in lots of literature. Alfred Flechtheim, one of the famous gallery owners of modern paintings, and so there is obviously also this myth that any modern house must have a modern client, and obviously I never sort of checked, can an art dealer actually earn that much that he can build himself such a large house? And here we have another manager sort of in the economics, but that's just sort of a small correction. But so again, we see even in this house where sort of one thinks he sort of really tries to merge certain traditions in British or English architecture, that underpinning this is still this memory of his life or his experience of German architecture. This is his own interiors of his own apartment in St. John's Wood Terrace, the living room, the bedroom. This was the bedroom of Lucy and Ernst Freud. These furnitures all come from Berlin, but then they are put together in this nice three-dimensional puzzle to make these large pieces of furnitures from large environment into a very small, fitting them into a small house. Freud, by the way, in this house removes all fireplaces and all flutes. Things totally unnecessary. We have electric panels in the ceiling so that he gets every single square foot you can squeeze out of these relatively small houses, small compared to the large apartments they lived in Tiergartenviertel in Berlin. So he lives really initially in his period with Berlin, and he makes these compromises. He begins to adjust himself to London architecture, and the same even applies for this most English building type, the little cottage in Walberswick. And this is when Esther Freud took me I met her with her in Walberswick, and she showed me around, and I was totally struck by this particular bow window, and I thought, Freud, of course, as we know, had a house, and this is a photograph of his cottage in Hiddensee, in the Baltic Sea in Germany. So Hiddensee, hidden house, so it's a play on this German word. This was an old building where the Freuds had this half, and he refurbished this half. But what is the really interesting thing, when you see this, then you think of these cottages in Hiddensee. So this is modern architect Max Taut, a famous Berlin architect from the 20s, modernizing traditional cottage architecture. And if you look at how he puts these square windows sort of projecting in the corner, then you can sort of see the influence that Freud was obviously to try to, on the one hand, have a traditional cottage, on the other hand, to modernize the cottage with these very subtle references to sort of buildings he must have known in his time when they went on to weekend trips to Hiddensee in Germany. And then here a wonderful, which I just threw in here, beautiful sketch by Neutra, which I only found in the Neutra archives a few months ago, 1948, Walberswick. Apparently, Neutra visited Freud in Walberswick. There is no other reason for Neutra to show up in Walberswick other than that there was some link with Freud having a cottage in... So I thought I'd just show you this beautiful sort of sketch of Neutra, of the village green, and then the Freud house is somewhere on the corner of this village green. Okay, let's move into this other area of Freud's architecture, the famous consulting rooms. This is the floor plan of the Vienna apartment. Unfortunately, it's all inscribed in German, but the only thing which really interests us is this area excuse me, this area here, this is the famous treatment room, here is the couch, this is Freud's study or office space, this is the waiting room. So when you came up those stairs, you rang the doorbell, you were led into the waiting room, and then through this little door, Freud could get you into the treatment room, and after your session you were kind of shuffled out through a sort of small door here. This is where Freud had his medical chair when he had to start sort of taking care of his own cancer. So you kind of through the back door, so to speak, the emergency exit almost, you then sort of get shuffled out that same door. So for an architect, this looks not well planned. It looks like sort of muddling through, higgledy-piggledy, adjusting an old building. Found a very nice letter from Anna Freud where she describes that her brother visits the family in Berlin. And in the short time he, Ernst, was here, he wanted to make all sorts of improvements in order to demonstrate to all of us what we should do in an improved manner. So in short, he behaves like an architect. Once you're an architect, you see precisely where people take the wrong corners and the house the wrong turns, and all you think is of, we can make that better, we can improve this, we can sort of save you three steps. And then if you read the rest of the quote, very interesting, he charges her with, Anna is conservative, and he obviously is the most radical person on the planet, and he sort of tries to reorganize this, but Anna holds her ground. I believe that he is wrong because I live here. I know that everything came about somehow over the course of time according to the essence of the humans around us, and I orient myself accordingly. So really interesting sort of gap opens here between an architect, a modern architect who wants to modernize, and sort of a person who lives somewhere and sort of knows that to live means to have tradition, to do quaint things, to do strange things in your own four walls, which is not necessarily open to improvements of an architect. This is the list of consulting rooms I have been able to establish. There may be more, but these are the ones I learned about. Very interesting, almost no private consulting room. By private consulting room, I mean a room where we have an identifiable psychoanalyst. Almost none of these rooms has ever been photographed. Very, very interesting phenomenon. So Carl Abraham, Lampe, Sandorado, René Spitz. I have not been able in over 10 years to ever find photographs of these consulting rooms. I think one reason is that all the consulting rooms were attached to their private homes, either apartments or houses. And there seems to have been a real sort of issue that the consulting room is a private space where something happens between you and the analyst or the therapist, and that cannot get out into the public. I would say this is actually the professionalism of the therapist, is that everything stays in this room, right down to where you put yourself on the couch. So whatever you do in the room, in this little ritual, on the couch, off the couch, and then wherever the analyst sits behind you, next to you, that stays totally in the private realm. That, I think, is my best explanation why this doesn't exist. When we then look at some of the rooms he designs in the UK, and I show you this image in a moment, we have a photograph of Melanie Klein's consulting room. But the sneaky thing is, where the couch stands, the photograph has been cut. So we have exactly the same phenomenon. The couch has not been shown in the photograph. The same Ernest Jones consulting room, the Käthe Friedländer and the Hilde Maas Käthe Misch consulting room sanatoriums, this was not realized. Of this room, again, I have not been able to find a photograph. Then, of course, we do have photographs of Sigmund Freud's consulting room downstairs in this very building. And, of course, we have also photographs of Sigmund Freud's Viennese consulting room, but they were only photographed the very moment where it was clear that this room will no longer exist because Freud had to go into exile. So the moment it was on the brink of getting lost, then the privacy concern was obviously not that big anymore, and it was photographed. We do have photographs, however, of what I call public consulting rooms. Those are rooms where not a particular psychoanalyst has his or her own office, so to speak, but where you work in an institutional setting, the psychoanalytic clinic, Schloss Tegel, or the polyclinic for psychoanalytic treatment in Berlin, those were sort of where several psychoanalysts were working, and they were sharing rooms throughout the week, throughout the day. Those rooms have been photographed. And I think in this case, the photograph of the room stands in for the individual analyst. So if you go to do analysis with Sanderado or René Spitz, then it is the name who sort of guarantees the quality of what the treatment you will receive. If you get treatment in these clinics, then it becomes the physical setting that is a professional setting that indicates that there is nothing weird happening, that you are not entering some kind of cabinet of Dr. Caligari or something, but that you're entering a room with a couch and a chair and a window and a potted plant. So it's a quite comfortable environment where you can actually sort of begin your treatment. So this is again the Lampelhaus. This is where we know the consulting room was. This was the waiting room. This is the only photograph we have of the desk, and this photograph is here. Well, okay, how can we identify this? We have the bookshelf, and then you can see here and there and there. You can see that the curtains are lighter, so that's where the windows are. And so we only have two windows in the consulting room, but we have four windows here, one, two, three, so we know that this desk was somewhere in this particular corner. Melanie Klein's consulting room, Clifton Hill in London. This is where she sat. This was a combination of her living room and her consulting room. The couch was standing somewhere here. This is where she was sitting. And again, so we see her chair, but that chair we don't realize is the consulting chair because it's the same series as the sofa and the other chair over here. However, this photograph allowed me then to identify that this was the couch of Melanie Klein. This was in the consulting room of Donald Meltzer, whom I met in 2003, just before I moved to California, because I had learned somehow that he had inherited from Melanie Klein the chair and the couch. Or at that point, I only knew that he had the couch. When I entered this room, I saw his consulting chair standing here, and I immediately realized, that's that chair. So that sort of allowed me to bring this together. Now, first of all, I'm not a photographer. Second, I said already earlier, this was a tiny room with very old sort of Donald Meltzer in the room, myself in the room, so there was very little space to actually maneuver, and it was before you had digital cameras. But this is how close I ever got to see a Freudian consulting couch. The original fabric was still, the soft furnishing was still on the couch. Then I moved to California, and we can see here, this is the couch in the Frank Country House. It's obviously just the couch in the reception hall, but you can see sort of the cane siding here and the same type of cane siding on this couch. So then Donald Meltzer passes away in 2004, and ever since then the couch has gone missing. There is a Donald Meltzer Trust. They have a website. I've written several times to them. I never received a reply. I have no idea where this couch is today, if they knew that this was a Freudian, a Freud designed couch, or if it was thrown out, or maybe somebody has the couch, one hopes. Somebody actually has the couch, and one hopes that they also realized that this was the original fabric on that particular piece of furniture. This is the oldest consulting room we know in Berlin from the polyclinic for psychoanalytical treatment. Freud designs the interior in 1920, and again in 28 when the clinic moves into new premises in Berlin. And this is a photograph from the new premises, because in 1930 the clinic celebrated its 10th anniversary and they published a small booklet, and that's where they have photographs of their interior in this booklet, which also functioned for them as a promotional piece of writing. So here we have the original Freudian consulting room, and then here we have the architect's son, first of all, clearing out all the clutter. All those, you know, those knick-knack and nippers and pictures on the walls, all goes. We are a modern architect in the 1920s. We don't want any ornamentation. We don't want anything which collects dust and sort of microbes and bacteria. We want clean lines, clean interiors where we can focus on the essential, and that's what you get if you ask the modern architect to design your environment. You get a comfortable couch, the chair. Obviously, the couch mimics this very high head end of the original couch, and then there is a footprint of Freud and a little desk, and then here's the famous potted plant where you can just make out those three leaves, a small desk, a chair, a lamp, and then there is some window behind it, so there's a thick curtain in front of the window. Bare wooden floors, just painted, no rug, no carpet, nothing. So this is where you start your process of healing. Here is the room of the consulting doctor. So there was obviously always a doctor in this clinic, sort of to receive emergency patients. And again, the couch, the chair. So it's very much a Freudian setting where the therapist sits at the head end of the patient. And then here, obviously, we have a meeting room table and some storage space for files and things like that. Then in 1927, we have Simmel designing the clinic sanatorium Schloss Tegel in the north of Berlin, which was an attempt to set up a larger psychoanalytic clinic. It was not in the famous Humboldt Schloss, which Schinkel designed in this ground, but there was a building which was put up in 1906 for a medical clinic where you could sort of get cold water treatments and drink special waters and those kind of things. And then during the First World War, and this is what the postcard shows, it served as a military hospital, and then Simmel signs a long-term contract for this building, and then the economic enterprise, however, falters for economic reasons in the early 1930s. Ernst Freud gets the commission to redo the entire interior. When the sanatorium goes bankrupt, part of the bankrupt proceedings is an inventory, and from this inventory we know that there were 24 patient rooms, there were 3 consulting rooms, we know precisely how many bedside tables, how many chairs and things Freud designed. We also know that the director, Mr. Simmel, drove a Citroën car, which was paid out of the sort of the proceedings of this clinic, and may also have contributed to the economic failure of this particular enterprise. And here we have the Freudian rooms. These are the guest rooms. So you could either be in the sanatorium on your own, then you get a single bedroom where you have your bed, you have a day bed, you have a desk, you have a little terrace with sort of some wicker furniture, bedside table and chair and your bed, and then here another small sort of table. Every piece of furnishing is designed by Freud. You have cork flooring, you have sort of lightly colored walls, and there's a wonderful quotation in the brochure. This is all from a promotional brochure, because this sanatorium had to sell its services, so they had to make this work, and so they did this beautiful design brochure and sort of indicating with these rooms, this is all really nice, very professional, you can come here with your money with us and receive psychoanalytic treatment. Then there were double bedrooms, so there was a bed for a couple, so they were larger rooms where they had a small sitting area and so on. Again, every single piece of furniture, and you can see the furniture reminds us a little bit of these chairs Freud had in his own office. He designs the rugs, the colors, and he claims that the color was very important for the success of the treatment. So he chose the colors very carefully in terms of yellow, orange, brown, and one wonders if he had sort of an early anticipation of the 1970s. This is then the consulting room in this particular clinic. So we have here an Ernst Freud-designed couch. I'm going to say a little bit about this in a moment. A small table, and then we have a specially designed chair for the psychoanalyst, and then a little table with a telephone so that you're not entirely on your own with your patient. You can lift the receiver and order whatever help or support you actually need. Once again, the clutter is out. It is just the essentials in the room. So let's look first briefly at the chair. Freud was very familiar with what the Germans call Strandkorb, wicker beach chair. They have extendable footrests. They're very popular with politicians. You can only use them very well to lock these people up and throw the key away in those chairs. But the important part is you pull out this footrest. And I know this very well because this is sort of childhood on the Baltic Sea. And so when you see here that Freud designs this chair, he obviously thought about the poor psychoanalyst who has to put his or her feet somewhere. So there is this little footrest you can pull out, and then it sort of slumps down and you can put your feet down there. And so I'm almost certain that Freud picked up this detail with this very peculiar chairs you can find at the German Baltic coastline. And then the actual couch, and in this case we actually have a drawing for the couch, which first of all makes you wonder about Freud's drawing skills, because this is apparently a person lying on the couch. Now, I try to be an architect, I shall not comment on drawing skills. You should see me doing such a drawing. And then, of course, we have Freud's instructions. He says that this part here has to be very, very well upholstered so that it can carry the weight of the patient. And then this part is flat. And down here, he says we have linoleum. And then up here, this part, you can see here, there are two hinges, so you can lift this up. There's a storage space underneath where you can put some cushions or extra sort of whatever, blankets or whatever you need. The material, the upholstery, no idea what the material is. To me, it looks some kind of velvety material. Colors, absolutely no idea. Where these couches went when the sanatorium went bankrupt, no idea. We know that Eva Rosenfeld or Eva Maria Rosenfeld, she worked in the sanatorium, and when they went bankrupt, they couldn't pay the last paycheck. So they all paid off the staff with couches. So I got into touch, thanks to Michael Molnar, with the son of Eva Rosenfeld. And I thought, maybe he has the couch. So I wrote a nice letter to him, and he writes back to me, and he says, yes, I remember the couch really, really well. He said it wasn't this couch. It was just a flat couch. And he said, I remember it very well because my wedding night happened on this couch. And the couch went the same way as the wedding. It all belongs now to history. So that couch apparently is no longer existing. Interesting was, however, that Rosenfeld took the couch with her into exile to London, but it was not this treatment couch. Because this couch, I think, clearly is a treatment couch. It doesn't look comfortable to me just as a daybed where you just want to take a little nap. Now, Freud, of course, has to make money. So he comes up, he designs only once in his career this specially made treatment couches, and then he has a standard type of couch. So if you're a psychoanalyst, you get a drawing where it says treatment couch. If you just want a daybed, you get essentially the same drawing and it says chaise longue or daybed. So that's obviously him also economizing of how many different designs of couches you can put up or you put together. So those are the standard couches, and something along those lines probably Rosenfeld brought with her to London when she went into exile. There is an unidentified drawing in the Freud collection at the Royal Institute of British Architects, and I think this is possibly Ernst Freud's drawing for this very building. Because this is a drawing where clearly it's not his couch. And we can indicate here that there is some soft furnishing over the couch, maybe the oriental rug or something similar. We can see a chair which looks very, very similar to Sigmund Freud's chairs. The position of the chair is more or less the same. There is an indication of artwork on the walls, and then, of course, the ordering hand of the architect. That visual chaos of that place in Vienna with all these books and things, we can't have that. But we can have nice bookshelves where we sort of arrange things in a symmetrical manner. So in this case, he actually goes back to this classical positioning of the chair and the couch in opposition to what he does here, because he also puts, obviously, the psychoanalyst in a very different position. The psychoanalyst suddenly has the patient perpetually in the view line. I'm not an psychoanalyst, so I have no idea how important that change is for the psychoanalytical process. I have not been able to find out who initiated this change. Was this Ernst Zimmer? But even still in the 1950s, we have handbooks for psychoanalysis where changing this spatial arrangement is sort of considered to be the equivalent of a communist revolution in political systems. So Freud obviously follows here from, I would presume, that Zimmer and his colleagues give him instructions for changing that particular spatial setting. So in this drawing, I think he really goes back, and if we look here sort of at the upper part of the room, with the railing for the images. So I have a strong sense that that is sort of his initial sketch, how to rearrange the consulting room then in this very setting when his father comes in 38 to London. And finally, of course, Freud also can do what in 1923 he could not do, rearrange the way how Sigmund Freud is living in space. Because finally he had to do the house for Sigmund Freud, so he can do what he wanted to do when he was young and enthusiastic as an architect, rearranging everything for the sake of a better spatial flow in the apartment in Vienna. Of course we know, these are obviously images I have to thank the museum for, we know of course that it then didn't quite work out, so this spatial arrangement is slightly different with the couch, with the images, but we can see here again, this attempt at symmetry, that we have these Biedermeier cabinets sort of symmetrically in the larger wall of books. So there is the ordering hand of the architect is clearly visible in these images, even though it is no longer the ordering hand of a radical architect who wants to revolutionize the way somebody lives in his environment. It is obviously here an architect who sort of tries to, he must have known that this is the last place his parents most likely will ever live in, and so obviously creating an environment which again offers enough reference points to make him feel at home. There's a very, very nice letter by Sigmund Freud where he actually describes that somehow, but he can't explain why, he says everything, and he talks about his anti-collection in this context, sort of any of these what I earlier described, respectless as clutter. So those anti-collections, those objects, where Sigmund Freud says somehow all these objects are far more visible in the new home here in London than they were in the Viennese home. And again, I think it has partially to do with sort of Freud arranging them as much as he can against light backgrounds so that the object stands out. But then Sigmund Freud, in the end, he was not an aficionado of architecture, he then says, but it is still a dead collection because I can no longer add things to the collection. So that was obviously the more important point for him that he wanted to add, and he could no longer for age and financial reasons and so on. So that's how I would like to finish my talk with Freudian men at their desk, watching and watched by their gods and goddesses. And I think it's quite interesting if one then, and I see the original is watching me here from the corner, sort of the posture, the gesture, how they sit at their desk. I don't think that sons ever can get far away from their fathers. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you so much. You've talked quite well. Do you have time for a couple of questions?
I have time for questions. I'm very happy. And I hope I can answer them. Please, go ahead.
You don't mention it, but I'll take you back to 1920, mm-hmm. when Freud was just making his way in the world as an architect and doing a lot better than Richard Weitzman. Don't you think one of the main reasons for that was that he had contact with his Berliner colleagues of his father, backsighting and
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. I think when Freud moves to Berlin with or in to follow his future or soon to be wife, because they married May 1920, he had sort of, there were two lines where I think he got his commissions from. The one was, as you pointed out, the psychoanalysts in Berlin, Max Eitingon, really, really important. Eitingon supported the father, he also supports the son. So Eitingon tries to get Ernst Freud a commission in Palestine, because that was also sort of shortly after the Balfour Declaration, and Palestine suddenly became a real possibility for young Jewish architects, engineers to build. That scheme fails, but then Eitingon puts money into the psychoanalytic clinic, and so that's absolutely right. So there is one line where Freud gets commissions through fellow psychoanalysts. I mean, the Lampelhaus is another example where psychoanalysts from the Freudian, a sort of Sigmund Freudian context in Vienna, then give Ernst Freud a commission in Berlin. The other line, of course, is through his wife. Because she comes from this wealthy family, and because they were socially so well connected, many of the early commissions one has to presume, come through the wife. It's very difficult to find this out, but there are some letters by Neutra where he sort of says, well, he has this wealthy wife, he has all these connections, and that is obviously a layer of clients, which even when Germany was suffering from this hyperinflation, they obviously sort of knew that this is the time where you take out mortgages, because the inflation basically pays the mortgage and you can actually build houses, and that's a way where you can actually carry some of your wealth over into sort of over this period of inflation. But there is a third group of clients where I simply don't know where they come from. Freud builds in his early career, he builds for Swiss businessmen. And there's sort of people where it is impossible to establish, are they of Jewish background? It is impossible to find out, or for me it was impossible, were they connected to the Brasch family? So I think the name Freud may have also had a certain attraction for some clients outside psychoanalytical track, if one can call it that way, and outside of the family connection through his wife. So I think Freud, in that regard, probably was lucky that he sort of had the social setting through his father, earned through his wife. And she also worked sort of in his office. When he is away, she kind of keeps a list of phone calls coming in, and sort of she sort of is partly involved in keeping this or putting this enterprise on a sounder footing. Please.
Do you know the Freudians chose Warburg? What's the connection? What took them to Warburg?
I have no idea.
No,
I mean, there is... I don't know, when I went there meeting with Esther Freud, and we were walking, and she showed me this house and that house, and then we looked at some houses, and we thought, maybe this house, maybe that house. And then eventually we walked on the... Do you call it dike?
The
kind of what sort of prevents the sea from coming. So we climbed on that and we looked out over the ocean. And then I remember I said to Esther, I said, now I know why he moved to Waterswick. Because it looks precisely the same as the Baltic Sea in Germany. Totally the same. So suddenly...
How did he find it?
Well, that, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me from the little what I learned from this one day visit and through Esther, that of course it was not just Freud who lived there. I mean, there were a number of friends. So one could say that maybe Warburg, for whatever reason, suffered a particular kind of Germanic takeover through the later 1930s, because there was a real group of, and some of them were friends of the Freuds, there was a real group of German Jews who went to exile, and they ended up in Warburg in that area. But so I'm not sure. I mean, there was a certain attraction, probably Warburg as an artist village, because we know, for example, that Charles Rennie Mackintosh from Scotland, he already was in Warburg, sort of much earlier. That, of course, is also an opportunity for this interesting anecdote that Mackintosh, of course, was arrested in Warburg because during the First World War, because he spoke that strange accent, and somebody thought he must be a German spy. So there is obviously a kind of certain history with German accents and Warburg. But ultimately, I also suspect that Warburg at that time probably was also quite affordable. But I don't know, that there may have been an economic reason. Can you add to this?
Yes, I can.
Good, go ahead, please. Let me write. If I...
He even first asked to go to Warburg because he wanted to replicate the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my uncle, so I didn't know his work coming out. And he started converting houses for his friends there. They came after him.
But then, I mean, do you think he went literally on a driving expedition along the coast to find...
He didn't drive.
Yeah, but I mean, trying to find a place. Right.
I mean, he had loved the Baltic to find a similar boat home.
I mean, that really struck me once when I went there and we looked at the actual over the waterfront.
And it was the nearest house to the sea. And he converted it, as you show. And he then started attracting other people. The houses he converted.
So, I mean, that would then mean that obviously this impression that that really evokes the Baltic Sea in certain parts in Germany, and that, as I said, that was when I suddenly thought, oh wow, this just looks like the Baltic Sea now, with once you overlook that landscape towards the water.
Please. And just to mention it here, can you talk about Franz Jung, the relationship connected to Franz Jung?
I have no idea, no record, nothing. I mean, that Freud...
Interesting, he was obviously an architect.
I know.
Coming together, the publishing.
But there was no, I mean, I never came across any sort of record or any mentioning before, sort of during Freud's active architectural career. I mean, when Freud gets on in age, eventually he sort of loses, I think it's very interesting, his architectural career, when he moves into exile, it actually continues. It's because we think of exile as this radical break. And in Freud's case, the exile changed his architectural practice, but the practice continues. So the commissions become smaller, and he no longer does these lavish country houses, but he continues building. I mean, sort of the Frogner Close, 1936, so he has these really sizable commissions, and when he gets the commission for Frogner Close and then the big apartment complex, then he writes to his wife and he sort of says, I think we can now venture into looking for a replacement for Hiddensee, for the cottage. So he obviously realizes that economically he's doing reasonably well and he can now spend extra money on acquiring a cottage and then refurbishing a cottage. And then I think the big changing point in the career for Freud comes in the Second World War, when eventually sort of the economy, and there were all sorts of economic restrictions on doing private housing, private buildings, and then when the Second World War comes to an end, the scene in Britain, of course, has changed. There is then the attempt to erect a welfare state, and then suddenly social housing is what architects are supposed to do. The big social housing schemes, sort of the big competitions, and Freud suddenly sort of is an old-fashioned architect who has almost his entire life built private houses for private clients. And so that is the moment when you do a statistic, how many projects he has per year and so on, it is totally clear that the Second World War is what really finishes his career as an architect. He has barely any commissions after that. He still continues a few things, but nothing sort of really sort of on a greater scale, and he works in the end out of a garage at the far end of his property, and he tries to participate in some big social housing competitions, but he obviously doesn't win, and we don't have the drawings, so we don't know what he was really suggesting. So that is sort of where things change. And then, at that moment, he then begins sort of taking interest in his father's writings and the letters. So that part in his life where he becomes an editor with Lucy, and then with there's a German psycho... Yes, thank you. It's a Gubris Dimitris. So that sort of comes relatively late in his life, that he then sort of removes himself more and more from being an active architect. He continues doing things for the family, sort of he does a little change in the house of Anne Freud and Stephen Freud, so he does small things, but he then sort of turns towards working on his father's writings and publishing them. But up to that moment, I have never, ever found any reference or anything him saying about Jung or about psychoanalysis. But Freud also wasn't a person who writes a lot. There is almost no writing about his architecture. Very, very little. There is a letter to the editor, and there are a few articles here and there. But that's it. There are no great statements, manifestos, what modern architecture is supposed to be. So we have to kind of interpolate and sort of try to draw conclusions from the little evidence we actually have. Okay, we start there and then we move you into the front, please.
You write in your book that he was surprised when he arrived in the early 1930s how British architects or Britain didn't know modern movement architecture. Mm-hmm. So would you say that he just stick to modern movement architecture here in London too, or he accept because of the new clients, some of the English art mm-hmm, as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I think, I mean, I probably gave you today, and it's quite deliberate, so a rather one-sided view of Freud's architecture by emphasizing where are traces of German architecture in his London or English designs. But one could do another half to this, where one could actually see where is he introducing English references, and he studies very carefully English architecture. Now, the most continental architects, of course, they did think, and I'm afraid to say probably they do think, still, some of them at least, that there is no decent modern architecture in Britain. So that was sort of a clear, especially in the 20s and 30s, that was the standard assumption that for somehow the British, they never mastered modern architecture. Now I think for an architect who goes into exile and who decides he wants to live here, that is of course a position one should not have. Because if you want to set up an office here, you don't sort of first of all insult the host and then sort of expect that the host gives you commissions to work with. And it's interesting when you look at the first clients Freud has once he's here in 33, there are some fellow exiled or emigres. Some of them he knew in Berlin. Some of them he worked for in Berlin, and he works for them again in London. But there are also immediately clients which are new, which there is no link to his earlier life. So he immediately picks up clients in the United Kingdom, which are for him totally new clients. Some of them have Jewish background, but then progressively they become more and more simply middle-class clients. So he's no longer entirely sort of focused or restricted, if that's the word one can use, to a Jewish sort of background group of clients. And so I think Freud, when he sort of says there is no modernism in Britain, I think Freud is also a little bit dishonest to himself, because he was not a hardcore modernist in the Germanic sense. I mean, if you compare sort of Mies van der Rohe's Tugendhat House and Freud's Country Villa, I mean, it's quite clear that the Country House Frank is very beautiful, very modern, very luxurious, but it doesn't have this radical edge. So it is not ours which tries to convince you that you have to change the total way in which you live. It modernizes the way you live, whereas the Mies van der Rohe house or some of these other radical houses, they really require that you totally rethink the way you actually live in an open floor plan house. So I think Freud is pretty good sort of in negotiating this kind of compromise. And there is a wonderful example. He designs a house in Berlin for the perfume manufacturer Scherk, which sort of he tries to do a Mendelssohn house, but it sort of has a nice aerodynamic corner and curve, but it is all a little bit heavy-handed. And it's sort of made from brick and sandstone, and there's a piano room. So it's not quite, it doesn't have this drive, this dynamism of Mendelssohn architecture. But then when he is in London, he publishes this house, and it's compared with a house in Cambridge, a very radical modernist house in Cambridge. And the way then the Freudian house, which in Berlin sort of people yawn when they see this house, but here in the British context, that house suddenly appears as a humanistic modernism, where sort of there are references to modernism without radically changing your house. So he kind of positions himself very, very carefully. He tries really to avoid showing up as the person from the continent who tells you guys now, this is what you actually have to do and I can tell you how to do it. Because, I mean, if you see, Gropius never could get the foot on the ground in the UK. Mendelssohn tried, very successful, Baxter Pavilion, but in the end, it didn't really work out. And I think partially for them, the problem really was that they weren't able to do this compromise. And there's a very nice letter where Freud goes, when he is on this exploratory visit in London, he is invited by some British architect, and he has a conversation with him about how he can work and so on, and then he's invited in the evening to come back for drinks, and he goes there for drinks, and Mendelssohn is there. Mendelssohn and some other big wigs, sort of big names. And afterwards, Freud writes about this dinner, and he sort of says, it was all about Mendelssohn. Nobody ever asked how hard it is for me to make a life in London. And that, I think, is really interesting in the way it sheds light on Mendelssohn, that Mendelssohn had this sort of, I am the star, I am the great German modernist architect, and whereas Freud sort of, he has a certain And that's what I always liked about him. For a long time, I wanted to call the architects the book Inconspicuous Houses, and the publishers sort of thought, this is impossible, you can't sell a book. And I still think Inconspicuous Houses is the best way one can describe his domestic architecture, because the houses are there. They are there in the background, they serve, they function, they're fantastically well built. This guy knew so well how you put bricks together that even the country house in East Germany, after it was used for all sorts of things, I mean, the substance of the house was so good. And that's where I sort of think he just wanted to do houses which serve their inhabitants in all sorts of ways. And that's why I think he, in the end, was successful to some degree. Initially in the United Kingdom, until then, with the Second World War, the whole architectural scenery radically changed, and then he was suddenly old-fashioned. There's no other way to describe this. There was another question, please.
Can I ask about Belvedere Court?
Yes.
So first of all, can I ask, was that his only Art Deco building? Secondly, how do you think he got the commission? And I was born and brought up there, and I'd say that after the 56 flats, pretty much all of them were occupied by Jewish-German refugees. So what was the connection, really?
I have no idea about the how he got the commission for that project. That is a real sort of lacuna in this whole project, that the British or the English side of this architecture is very little documented. So there is no archive. I mean, even if you go to the Royal Institute of British Architects, almost every drawing refers to his continental European work. And what he did here in England, I mean, you have to piece together from all sorts of objects, and I cannot answer the question how he got the commission, how those apartments, what was the sort of distribution, how he got into one of these apartments. I think architecturally, Belvedere Court is very, very interesting, because if you look at the main facade along the street, I think it's just really, really nice how he balances those staircases, how he sort of pulls the horizontal lines through. I think it's a really, really interesting way, and how the different three or four parts of the buildings are slightly angled to each other so that it is not just a long, boring apartment complex. So that he does really well. Where I think the project kind of is interesting is on the other side, where then, you know, all the pipes come down the facade, or so where you have sort of the front and you have the back of the house. That, I think, is a very interesting juxtaposition, which I have never seen in any other Freud project, that you have very much a representative, beautifully designed front facade, and then you have the rear of the building, where sort of it has this kind of higgledy-piggledy qualities and all the piping. So where I think he, that at that stage, he really accepted, for whatever reason, what was the standard of how you did these buildings in Britain or in London at that time. Because if you look at comparable apartment complexes, sort of social housing complexes from the 20s in Berlin, you do not have this juxtaposition that the street facade is very beautiful, and then when you come to the garden side, sort of it's piping and things sort of visibly on the facade. But that, I think, is also an example where German and English building traditions are very different. That sort of, for a long time in Germany, all this gets hidden in the walls, and so that it is not visible, whereas here, for reasons of practicality and maybe also for reasons of climate, because you have much less with freezing weather to deal here, and those things are more visible. So that, I think, is a very, very interesting project, but it does show, I also think, that Freud was capable to design decent housing where you not have one sort of individual detached building or semi-detached buildings, so that he could handle sort of the large masses of this apartment block in terms of scaling and fitting it into the neighborhood, right down to the floor plans of these individual apartments. So I'm afraid I can only give you half of an answer, and I just don't know how the commission came to him. So please.
One last question.
Okay.
And
it's probably yeah, be honest.
I'm going back to this house here.
Mm-hmm.
Then his parents came over. Was the house furnished? Was it all set up for them, or what was the state?
So when The Freud family came from Vienna. So Ernst had kind of scouted out this house and decided that this is the place where his parents would live once they installed in London. But then, of course, by that time, the parents were very advanced in age, and there were, Sigmund Freud had serious health problems, so he had to do all sorts of changes in the house and to make it sort of livable for Freud as his treatment space and as a family space. And the apartment in Vienna, of course, was always extremely cramped, and, you know, there was an aunt living there, and Anna was living there, and Anna had her consulting room, and so the whole thing in Vienna was really a kind of shambles in terms of architecturally how they use the spaces. So then Sigmund Freud comes, and initially they lived in Ellsworthy Road. And so they rent an apartment there. And while this building is still sort of under construction, so the house had been gutted, a lift was put into the house, and then some changes were implemented in the distribution of rooms. The little extension where now the bookshop is was added to the house with the glass, circular glass bricks in the ceiling. So this was still a building site. Sigmund Freud, there are wonderful letters in the collection of the correspondence of Sigmund Freud where he describes that Ernst is this kind of magician who sort of has a wand, a magic wand, and sort of turns everything into this modern space with lifts where you only have to push a button and you get out electrically moved upstairs and downstairs. But there is this moment where Sigmund Freud, they're basically waiting for this house to be finished. How long it took for the furniture to arrive from Vienna, that I actually don't know. Because some of the furniture obviously was shipped from Vienna to London, some of the books, some then the antique collection. So how long it took for those things, did they arrive when the building work in the house was completed, I don't know.
Well, they arrived in August already, before they were actually moved into the house. So it must have been in storage in London.
Right. So they could actually install all the furniture. So that means then when Sigmund moved in, then it was actually sort of move-in ready, the entire house. So good.
I mean, I think the discussion could obviously go on and on, but and I think there will be some chance for kind of informal discussion as well afterwards down in the bookshop. But thank you so much. That was extraordinary. It was a kind of mix of architectural history, Freud family history, the history of psychoanalysis, and all with enormous kind of knowledge and energy and humour. And thank you so much.